We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we welcome back to the program writer and photographer John Katz. His latest book is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. Here's one of the thoughts John shares in the book's first chapter. Dogs have surely changed my life more than once. Later, he says, maybe the greatest gift animals give him is their mystery, what we cannot know. Both Izzy and Lenore, together with John, do hospice work. They are two of his dogs. The dogs are calm and loving and bring that gift to share with people at the ends of their lives. John Katz joins us to tell stories about these dogs and other animals he's known and how they've affected his life. And listeners, I hope you'll join us and share your stories with us as well. Questions, also welcome. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. John Katz is the author of many books, nonfiction and fiction. His most recent books are about dogs, farm animals, and rural life, including Izzy and Lenore, Dog Days, and A Good Dog. John writes on his blog that he has returned to writing fiction and hopes also to turn his attention to writing for children. You'll find his blog and his photos at his website, www.bedlamfarm.com. Soul of a Dog is published by Villard. Again, our phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I look forward to your telephone calls this afternoon. John Katz, how are you?
Good, Celeste. Thank you, and thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. How are the dogs?
The dogs are good. They're arrayed around me. I feel like the King of England. They're all very lying on their back, snoring, and waiting.
Yeah, and there's a new dog, Frida?
There's a new dog, the Hell Dog, we call her. Yes, Frida is a part Rottweiler Shepherd mix and was running wild in the Adirondacks before she was corralled and came to me through a new relationship I'm in. And so training Frida has definitely put to the test a lot of my theories about dogs. She tried to eat everything on the farm, and so far has failed, but not for lack of trying.
Oh. It was just about this time last year when we talked, right before Thanksgiving of 2008, and there have been some changes on Bedlam Farm.
Yes, there have been quite a few changes.
Yeah.
Well, most of the animals have departed. The sheep and the cows have all gone to Vermont, and the donkeys have gone to Vermont. And what happened was several things happened. I went through some personal changes. I was going through a divorce, and I also occurred to me that I needed to make a choice, really, in the next few years between whether I really wanted to be a writer or whether I really wanted to be a farmer, because the two were colliding more and more. You know, to run a farm, to deal with animals, to deal with hay and water and fences and vet bills and all that was just crazy. And it was fun. It was rewarding. I loved doing it. But I decided also I wanted to be more ambitious about my writing. I really wanted to return to fiction. And I undertook, to me, is the most exciting project I think I've ever undertaken, which is to write a novel called Rose in a Storm, which was told from the perspective of a border collie abandoned on a farm during a blizzard. And that was, just, you know, from the to write a, I read a novel narrated by a dog who doesn't talk. It's definitely a challenge. I just finished that. That's coming out next year. And I also decided to do children's books. So I've done three of those, and I have a fourth I'm working on. And I'm very excited about that. So I had to make some choices, really. I needed more headspace. And so the farm changed quite a bit.
Yeah. And there's a new woman in your life, Maria Heinrich, an artist.
Yes, I was going to mention her. Yes, thank you. It's a little hard for me to say I have a girlfriend. It seems like it's a hard thing to get out, but I do. And she's an artist. She's a fiber artist, and she's been working out of one of the barns making quilts and potholders. Frida is her dog. And that's been a wonderful new thing in my life.
Yeah.
And so something to share. And that's, yes, there's been quite a few changes, and almost all of them, I must say, are good. Some of them are painful, but they're also quite wonderful. I mean, creatively, I'm doing a bunch of photography shows and thinking about a picture book. So it's been an amazingly creative time as well as a time of change.
Yeah, I got my fingers crossed for that picture book.
Thank you.
And it's, I can hear in your voice, John, you've come through some things. I mean, I can't hear that, but I know from reading the blog that's the case. But you sound really good.
Thank you. Well, you probably can hear. As I recall, you're very perceptive, and you probably have a particular perspective talking to me every year or so. You probably have as good a perspective as anybody, better than some. I do feel people keep saying to me, you look happy. You look great. You look happy. And so it makes me understand that I guess I didn't look that way before, because nobody ever said that to me before. And I have learned a lot about myself. I think I've changed quite a bit and grown a bit. And I think that's not always easy for men to do. But it's very important and can be very healthy. You know, these were some things I just needed to face, and I did. And to be in love and to be sharing the farm with someone is just a miracle.
Yeah.
And so it's probably not unrelated to the other creative kind of openings that are going on, because I just I don't feel I've ever been in, had more creative energy or tried to do more creative things. I'm going to do two more novels, and this Rose series is going to be a trilogy. And I can't even tell you how excited I am about that.
Yeah. A couple of things that I really appreciated you writing about on your blog was, one was about fear, and another was about this idea that we have midlife crises, and this is something we in particular lay on men.
Yes, well, it's become a dear subject of mine, not only because I've lived it, but because I went through a bunch of things starting a couple of years ago with the marriage and other things too, and I decided to write about it. I decided to say, okay, I've had issues with fear and some issues with being depressed sometimes and anxious, and I got just an amazing response. It sort of coincided with the economic troubles, so I think a lot of people were feeling different kinds of fear, and it was very healthy to write about it. I also started writing more about this notion of men and changing. You know, when men change, people say they're having a midlife crisis, and when women change, people tend to think it's great, and they're creative and brave, and they usually write. But it's very hard for men to change in positive ways. You know, and often men don't change in positive ways. They drink or they have affairs or they buy motorcycles or big cars. And I think men struggle with how to change and also struggle with the fact that this idea of the crisis is wielded against them sort of like a club. I mean, you know, I got the farm when I was 56 years old. And I was, you know, that's an age where you're supposed to be sort of downsizing and settling down and getting ready for the long march. And I think it's very, very important not to be defined by other people's expectations of you. You know, midlife to me is a wonderful opportunity to grow, and you've learned some things and you know some things and you put a lot of battles behind, and it's a great time to change and take on new things. You don't have to just shrink your life. I mean, that's okay, too, if you want to do that, but I don't. And so some of the most wonderful things in my life have been coming at this point in life.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is an important thing to talk about.
Yeah. The livestock is gone from the farm, and I'm wondering what's that been like for Rose?
Yes, a lot of people on the book tour, everyone was very concerned about Rose. I mean, everyone was, how is Rose? What's going to happen to Rose? And Rose is an amazing character because she's been the underpinning sort of a lot lot of my life up here, including the novels. She's the inspiration for the novels, too. And Rose has been on the cover of three books and has inspired about five, so that's quite a dog. Rose is great. There's several things. You know, one, she was getting a bit beat up. She was wearing out a bit from the work. So she had a lot of hits on the head on the barn and was kicked a number of times and butted many times. So I was not unhappy to see her get a bit of an easier life. But secondly, you know, Rose is just up for things. And she, one of the many things I just love about Rose is she just accompanies me through whatever phases of my life I'm on. It doesn't have to be sheep. If you want to do sheep, that's great. If you want to, you know, move cows around, that's great. If you want to change and write children's books, that's okay too. So she just moves with my life, and she loves to go for ATV rides. She loves Frisbees now. She's actually playing quite a bit with Lenore, the Hound of Love. and she's, I can't hardly believe that she plays all day long. And she's actually, to me, and again, I'm probably not doing the best perspective, but everybody who sees Rose says the same thing they say when they see me. They say, well, you look happy. You're having fun. So she's doing great. I think it probably was time for her to not be so physical. And I also think she's having a blast, like chasing the Frisbee, chasing balls, running through the woods. And she has a spot in the garden where she likes to sit and command the world. So she's doing very well, and I promise people everywhere I will take excellent care of her because she's the franchise, you know. And she has to be happy, and she's fueling quite a bit of literature, so I'm going to take excellent care of her.
Yeah, okay. And Lenore and Izzy are taking good care of you, Lenore, the Hound of Love. And of Izzy, you say that he's permitted you this growth as a writer and a photographer and as a human being. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I had a theory that, you know, we get the dogs we need, you know, and if you let them, they can sort of guide you through these different passages of life. I mean, Rose was, I can't imagine having been on this farm without Rose dealing with these animals. Izzy was a different kind of dog. He's much more interior, and his work focuses very much on people and on me. And he led me into the hospice work, which has been very important for me. And he also was my partner in the photography. About 4 years ago, I'd never really taken pictures much and never thought about it that much. And about 4 years ago, I got this really strange itch to start taking pictures. And it had something to do with the blog, because I had this blog and I was writing about the farm and writing about the life. But I thought, well, God, wouldn't it be great, instead of just telling people what I'm doing, if I could show them? So I got a little camera, and I started taking pictures and putting them up on the blog. And then the blog took off, and then I started going through the divorce and this other stuff, and I just started going out at night with the camera. I was here alone, and I was very discouraged and very anxious and very unhappy. And I said, we'd say to Izzy, let's go chase some sunsets. And so I took this camera, and I had no idea how to use it, and just started driving all over the country and catching different sunsets, you know, through farms, through silos and barns. And then I started taking the camera on hospice visits with people's permission and taking pictures of them and Izzy, which everybody loved. And I put up a hospice journal on the website. And so the photography, several things happened that were just explosive. The pictures caused the website to take off because, you know, people are getting free pictures every day of dogs, you know, and people like that. I think that's the key. Excuse me. It's the key to happiness, is take pictures of dogs and put them on the internet, and you're going to do all right. And the hospice work was also very challenging for me as a photographer because there's no easy hospice pictures. You know, the light's never good, and you can't move people around. And then I began this new relationship with Maria, who's an artist and who was really encouraging me, talking about the pictures. And then I started getting email from photographers all over the place, beating me up, and you should try this, and you should try that, with very constructive advice. So all of these things converged, and suddenly this artist kind of came out. I don't usually refer to myself that way, but I don't know how else to describe it. It was I just loved taking pictures. I was taking them all day, pictures of raindrops, pictures of leaves, pictures of the dogs, sunsets, farmscapes. And Izzy was with me for just about every one of them, and I would get out of the truck. Izzy would get out of the truck. He would lie down next to the road, and just watch me. And I would take these pictures and try not to get run over. And we'd go to another place. And so now all I do is when I get the camera bag is he just comes along and it just sits with me. And he's like a muse. And I think the wonderful thing about dogs is their, I don't know, astonishing ability to kind of weave into your life in the way that you need them to. You know, Lenore, I call her the love dog because I think she really kept love alive for me when I needed that. Very loving. You can't look at her and not smile. And she's really a good time Charlie. I mean, she just lives to have fun. She plays with Frida. She plays with Rose. And you could not get Rose to play. I mean, nobody could get Rose to play. And Rose and Lenore play half the day now. So I think, you know, here I have these dogs, and each one of them has opened me up in a particular way or inspired me or accompanied me. And I think it's not an accident. You know, I think my expectations have had something to do with that. But that's quite miraculous. It's quite amazing, and I'm very fortunate in that way.
Yeah. When did you begin reflecting on the spirits of animals?
Well, when I bought the farm in 2003, I noticed a couple of things. One is that when I wrote a book about dogs, people came to the readings. That was important. And I thought, wow, this dog thing, this animal thing is really very, very powerful. People are really into animals. They love dogs. They love their cats. And I just was curious about why, what's going on here. And I thought it would be great to have a farm, which is kind of like a laboratory to explore that. And getting different kinds of animals, sheep, donkeys, cows, would give me a chance to look at them and observe them and live with them and get to know them. And then I saw this Harvard study, which asked Americans in 1960 if they thought their dogs and cats had souls. And 98% said no, that was a silly idea. And then they asked the same thing 3 years ago, and it was exactly the opposite. 98% said, of course they have souls. What a silly question. And I was like, wow, this is amazing, this turnaround in a generation. What's it about? And so I thought, okay, I'm going to pay attention to these animals and observe them and kind of see firsthand what it's about. And I was very touched by the fact that each of the animals I knew had a very different spirit. You know, Mother the barn cat. A friend of mine said her cats were like children, so I decided to observe my barn cat for a few hours. And it was quite an awakening for me because I thought, wow, it's like watching Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
And if she was just killing, dismembering, torturing things. And the cows had a whole different sense of acceptance and resignation. They were very good-natured. You know, they were very tolerant. They were very accepting of things. And each of the animals had a different kind of quality about them. And I came to see or feel that the spirit of an animal is really in the way they touch us and get us to react and enter our own souls. So that was very interesting. I thought, you know, this whole question of people and animals and the increasingly intense interactions between them is just really important for writers to look at. You know, some people will say to me, well, how come there's so many dog books? And I always say, I don't see why there aren't more, you know. There's 70 million dogs, and people are crazy about them. Mm. So you haven't even begun to really explore the subject.
Yeah, I think it's time I need to go back and reread the new work of dogs.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of maybe that's a pioneering book out there in the field, John.
Well, thank you. It was when I went to the University of Kentucky and wrote about the increasing impact of dogs on the emotional lives of people. And I think it was one of the first to kind of look at that, you know, we become a pretty needy culture. You know, our culture is pretty tense. Life is pretty intense in America. You know, the economy and technology and religion and politics are all pretty tense right now. And I think something people find as a fixed point of affection is animals. Unconditional love and unconditional support and companionship. It's a very, you know, when you come home at night, you know your dog is going to be glad to see you. So more and more, I think these animals are doing emotional work for people, and as they have for me, and entering our emotional lives and connecting with us. And that's become a very, very powerful force in American life. I mean, you know, pet health care, pet retail is one area of the economy that has not declined a bit in the last year or two.
Yeah.
We really care about dogs and cats.
Yeah. Do you think we connect with and bond with animals because they're different from us, or do you think we need to think they are like us, and that's why we attribute feelings and thoughts to them?
Well, I think in the last 30 years, we have just become more needy. You know, families are scattered, and jobs are uncertain, work is uncertain, technology is stressful and confusing, politics is kind of angry and dispiriting, religion has failed to kind of keep the place in our lives that it once had. So I think we need affection, we need attention, we need love, number one. Number two, I think you have to look at the difference in our response to animals. You know, dogs get to sleep in our beds, raccoons do not.
Mm.
And dogs do because they have evolved, and they know how to read us, and they know how to manipulate us. They know how to read our emotions and get us to love them. More and more, the intensity of feeling is seen in ways in which people relate dogs and cats to children. People tell you all the time, my dog is just like my kid. It's just like a child. When you start to see an animal as being like a child, then of course you feel more intensely about it. You grieve for it more. You feed it more and better things. You worry about it. You spend more on health care. You become more emotionally enmeshed with it. And I think that's what's happening. I think we're more and more equating animals with children, and they're tapping into this deep nurturing need in our society that we're not really doing for each other. Because this is really very new. I mean, this did not happen 40 years ago. You know, dogs weren't walked on leashes. They weren't given. I mean, dog food wasn't even invented until 1960. So this whole way of treating dogs and seeing them as our soulmates and, you know, our companions and as our therapists even, is very, very new. And I think it's reflecting a barrenness in our ability to support each other sometimes.
Mm. Can we use this example to pull ourselves back toward one another?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I'm almost never asked that, and I always think it's the best question to ask. Because I think the power of animals really is when they connect us to people. And when you talk about my life, you know, you have Izzy who brings me into hospice work, and I have these very powerful and intense relationships with people at the edge of life. Or Lenore, who I don't want to overstate it, but I think, you know, she really helped see how to love something and how to love some creature and led me to a person. And I think when at its most powerful, the relationships open us up and show us how to connect to human beings. Because I think when you don't do that, if you don't connect with animals, I think you're losing something. But if you only connect to animals, I think you're losing something. And the danger in what we're dealing with right now, I think, is it's so difficult to deal with people and it's so stressful to live. We just want the connection wherever we can get it. And quite often, more times than I would believe, people tell me, you know, dogs are good enough for me. You know, I'm sick of people.
Mm.
And that always makes me feel a little bit sad.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Writer and photographer John Katz is with us today. His latest book is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories. I look forward to hearing from you. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The bond is a two-way street, and you said animals, they learn how to read us, and there's an essay in the book titled Snickers for the King. The animal in focus alongside you is an immense steer named Elvis in this piece. Would you tell us about Elvis?
Elvis is a 3,000-pound Swiss steer who was headed for the slaughterhouse, and the farmer didn't want him to go, was kind of connected to him, and wanted to give him a couple of additional years of happy life. Now, steers don't live very long. They're bred to sort of, you know, be slaughtered young, and their legs sort of give out. So Elvis had two or three good years here, and I got very connected to him. He is a very genial, monstrous character who was a nightmare to care for, I have to say.
Yeah.
Because he's so big and he eats so much, and you can't really treat him. You know, you can't give a steer a needle if it doesn't want to get one. And I was always terrified he was going to just walk through the fence one day and pull the barn down. But I loved to sit with him, and I would read with him, and I would hang out with him, and I'd give him Dunkin' Donuts, chocolate donuts. He loved those. And I was very touched by his just genial, accepting nature. You know, it didn't matter if it was snowing or raining. You know, he didn't squawk or turn on the weather channel and see what was going to happen. He just rode with it. And you know, cats have that quality that I really like. They just take in the world, and they don't really need a lot of interaction. But he last year, when animals left the farm, he also was beginning to have a lot of leg trouble. And so I knew his time was coming. Rather than send him to a slaughterhouse, I did send him to be put down and his meat given to a homeless shelter in Glens Falls, mm-hmm. New York, where he has fed legions of homeless teenagers for some time now. So I thought that was a good, you know, a sad ending, but a good ending. And I think he had a great few years and a great time and a lot of Dunkin' Donuts, so he could already.
That's quite a picture you paint of him. A kind of slobbering chocolate.
Oh my God.
All over you.
He was. The problem with Elvis was that when he got affectionate, that was a problem. And he'd like to come over and suck the hat off my head and eat it. And every now and then, if I was wearing a sweatshirt, he would pick me up by the hood and sort of jangle me around a little bit. And I'm not that tiny. And he just bounced me up and down. And you'd have to smack him on the nose. And he would, when he saw me, he would come running down the hill. But, of course, he often couldn't stop. He was just so big.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be careful to get out of the way. You know, it's funny. It's dangerous, really, to have an animal like that as a pet, to be honest with you. I mean, they're just too big. And it's also, you know, especially last year, began to bother me a little bit. You know, these farmers would drive by who were all hanging on by their fingernails. And, you know, I had a 3,000-pound steer as a pet.
Mm.
So I thought it seemed increasingly inappropriate to me. I mean, I enjoyed the experience. It was a great experience. I love getting to know him, and I love having him around. But I also felt it was time. And, you know, I think it's a statement a little bit. I was not entirely comfortable with the idea of having two steers and a beef cow as pets.
Yeah. At the outset of this piece, Snickers for the King, you quote Thomas Merton, and Merton is talking about sanctity and salvation for us humans, and at the end of this epigraph, you write, you quote him, "We can be ourselves or not as we please. We are at liberty to be real or to be unreal. We may be true or false. The choice is ours." For these animals, though, that's not the case.
No, and I thought it was very important. I was very struck when I started researching the book to see that, you know, Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and Merton and all of these great writers had taken up this issue of animals and souls for years, for thousands of years, really. And they were very interesting things to say about it. You know, there was a line through the thinking that I have to say I did identify with. And I felt was right. And they point out that the great difference between people and animals and the souls of people and animals is that we have consciences. We have the ability to change our lives. We have the ability to choose to be better, even if we don't always do it. And animals, of course, are like trees. They accept the reality that they're in the moment. They live in the now. If they eat and they are around each other, they're content. And they don't, you know, they can't leave. They can't go to live some other place. They don't govern themselves. They can't get up in the morning and say, "Gee, I'm gonna change the nature of cows, and change their lives and create democracy." If you read Plato and Aristotle, what they thought was the most exciting about the human being, and remember this was thousands of years ago, humans were changing the world. They were inventing culture. They were inventing democracy. They were inventing literature and theater. So they thought that was sacred. The ability of the human being to evolve was the most sacred thing about humans. And animals couldn't do that, so therefore they were different. In our time, what I come to see is we're shifting gears, that we don't really like people much anymore. And we don't have such high hopes for them. And we're beginning to worship animals who can do no wrong. I mean, when's the last time you ever saw a dog criticize? And of course, while I relate to that, I love my dogs and certainly celebrate them. I think it's sad to see the difference in tone over these thousands of years, that people really have a lot good to say about human beings, and they're disappointed in them, and yet they feel animals can do no wrong at all. And that's another seismic shift that comes up when you begin looking at the relativity of spirits in people and in animal life.
Yeah, when you think of the animals that you've written about here in Soul of a Dog, there is certainly life, a life force within. And in a minute, maybe we can talk about Henrietta.
Yeah.
And they are so fascinating and interesting. And the thing about considering this should be for us to get us to think about what we value, how we treat one another, as well as the animals that we care for.
Well, so this was the Thomas Aquinas idea, the idea that the reason to treat animals well and to show mercy to them and love to them is that through that we can be better people and treat people better. And I have to say that has been very true in my life. I think every time I get a dog or get an animal, you know, you mentioned that I had changed, and I hope so. But if I have, a reason that I have is that each of these animals has shown me, I think, how to be better, how to be more accepting, how to be enter new experience, connect differently to people, be more patient, be more affectionate. And, of course, it would have been great if I learned this from people, but I didn't.
Mm.
And so I think they're a measure of our humanity in just the way you're talking about. I think it's very important to love them and treat them well, in its own sake, but I think the real benefit of it is that we learn thus to be more humane and be better to people. And I think that's the real payoff for having animals. But yet I also am very struck by the different spirits in these creatures. You mentioned Henrietta, who's a chicken who just had this very strange personality. She liked to hop on the backs of cows and donkeys and ride them around. And she followed me around like a puppy. She would run in the back door and like squabble around the kitchen if she could get in there, and just loved being around people, loved hanging out with you, and loved the dogs. And I never saw a chicken behave like that, and I couldn't really account for it. The same with the donkeys; they could be incredibly sweet and spiritual and intuitive. And all these animals had a different. I use the term animating spirit. You know, Rose was really about work. Lenore is about food and affection. Izzy had this amazing way of connecting with human need and reacting to it. But they're all different, and they do have very different spirits, and I think they do connect very powerfully to each other. They have very powerful relationships with each other. If you separate any of these animals, you see how agitated they get, how connected they are to each other. So the notion that I used was the animating spirit of an animal. You know, Mother, I mentioned Mother the barn cat. Extremely affectionate. She follows us on walks and loves to sit in my lap. But, God, she will kill anything and mm-hmm. torture it for the longest possible time. And she's just different from us. You know, we're just not like that. She's not like a child at all. And seeing those differences and those traits, I think, was fascinating for me.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing that animals are so wonderful for. They teach us, I hope, that we are different from one another. I mean, human and non-human animals.
Well, yes, and that's the kind of idea that I think would make a great children's book. You know, and the reason I'm enjoying the children's book idea so much, and I've written four of them already that not haven't come out yet, but is you take these idea of Lenore and her loving ways, or welcoming Frida, or the different spirits. I'm doing one of the children's books on how dogs dream, in which I invite the kids to co-dream with their dogs.
Mm.
And they are very different, and we can learn something from all of them if we're open to it. And it requires a lot of perspective, because people can get carried away with animal love. I mean, people are spending fortunes on health care and exotic diets and toys that are not necessary, and they are beginning to see dogs as children and treat them that way. And you have to be careful about it, because a society that – you know, mixes up dogs and children is not on firm moral ground, I don't think. And Plato would have been absolutely horrified by that.
Yeah.
You know, they're different, and it doesn't mean that they're worse or that we're superior or inferior. It just means we're very different, and I think I came out of the experience really respecting the difference. I don't want them to be like us. But when you love something that much and you think it's like a child, of course you want it to be like us. And so people project all kinds of human ideas onto them. And, of course, that can get you into trouble.
Yeah. Well, I have a cat who stays inside. He's a wonderful fellow, very loving. In fact, a cat sitter we had for us this fall while we were away said, affection is more important to this guy than dinner. And I think I would go up to a point on that. But, you know, the cat's got to eat.
Yeah.
But the cat's more interested in, when you come home, in greeting and receiving affection. And then in a little while, it's okay. You know, I'm sitting by the dish now. You know, get the food out.
Right. You wouldn't want to try that with that theory with Lenore. You would definitely.
Yeah, so
affection is important, but food is definitely more important.
Numero uno. Yeah. So anyway, where was I going with this? I did have this experience with this cat that told me he is very much a cat, and if he had the opportunity to take something down, to take a bird down or a mouse down, he would.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think, you know, cats are fascinating to me because they're not like dogs. You know, they're not totally domesticated, and they're killers. And they, you know, they're that doesn't make them any less wonderful. It just reminds us of that, you know, the differences between them. I mean, they're animals, and they have that very much in them.
Well, that's the agreement we made with them, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know if they made the agreement. I think we made the agreement. I think that these animals have really learned how to deal with us. And you know, human beings do not treat most species in the world very well. I mean, look at the, you know, squirrels don't get to sleep in bed. And cats and dogs do because they can read us and react to us. And we look into their eyes and faces and we see all kinds of things we recognize. Affection, you know, curiosity, intelligence, humor. And then we attach to them. And once we attach to them, we're off and running. But I think they are also manipulators. And dogs and cats are probably the leading manipulators in the animal world. I mean, they really know how to play us.
Mm.
They've been doing it for thousands of years, and they know how to do it. And they get us to take really good care of them.
Yeah. There's in Snickers for the King, you write about another writer by the name of James Serple, who happens to be a veterinarian who writes about the human-animal bond. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about his work and what insights his writing has provided you with.
Well, James Serple is a real inspiration to me. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Veterinary School, and he's what they call an animal ethicist, where he writes about the relationship between humans and companion animals, and especially dogs. He wrote a great book called The Domestic Dog, and he writes about this great irony of the reality of dogs, where dogs are probably the best treated and most abused animals there are. On one end of the scale, they're lavished with great food and gourmet treats and wonderful health care and lots of companionship. On the other, they're abandoned and kicked around and wantonly mistreated. We're very ambivalent about them. You know, people love dogs and will do anything for them, but also people abandon dogs by the millions. They get a dog and they think they're getting some Disney creature that is going to hold their hand and cuddle with them, and they get a dog that is, you know, vomiting and chewing and shedding and having diarrhea, and they don't want that. So I think it's tricky for dogs because if dogs, you know, dogs can't, and Serple writes very well about this, dogs can't really do any of the things that come naturally to them as far as people are concerned. We don't let them have sex. We don't let them run free. We don't let them squabble. And you know, we don't even let them walk off a leash. So almost all the things a dog naturally wants to do are either illegal or frowned upon. So there's a tremendous amount of tension in that. And so half the country doesn't want dogs anywhere near them, and half the country is wild about dogs and can't get enough of them. So life is complex for dogs. You know, they run into all kinds of different realities. You know, you walk down the street with a dog, and half the people will cross the street and glower at you, and the other half will come running up and line up and talk to the dog. So it's a very complex world that dogs are navigating and people are. And it's very challenging to have a dog, I think, and to train it well, get to know it, move freely about with it. It's not simple. So it's not a simple thing. I mean, we see a lot about dog live and we hear about it. But, you know, probably more Americans dislike dogs than love them and don't want them anywhere near them, and cats too.
Mm. Yeah, I think people even have stronger feelings about cats if they don't like them.
You think so? Yes. Well, I've not encountered that other than the barn cats. But yeah, cats, I think, also experience just a lot of, you know, misunderstanding and hostility.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to, you know, figure out where these animals belong in a world where there's so much controversy about their existence.
Yeah. Before we're totally out of time, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the hospice work that you began with Izzy and now Lenore is involved with as well. How did this work, or did this work, shape your thoughts and feelings about the animating spirits of animals? And if so, how?
I was very struck by the impact an animal would have on a person at the end of their lives. I mean, you'd walk into a home where somebody was dying, and they would just light up when they saw a dog. They would tell them stories and talk to them and just be thrilled. And I think Izzy in particular has a great gift for focusing in on people who need him. He really makes strong eye contact, very calm. He loves to be touched. So I could see his astonishing intuitiveness. What I was surprised by was just how much it meant to people. I mean, to have a dog near them and everything. They would tell Izzy stories, and they would trust him and love him and be very open to having him around. It was a very, very, very telling thing to see. And you could see this whole idea of what animals mean to people who are sick and in distress. In hospice, you also see a lot of the isolation of the dying. I call mm-hmm. the mistreatment of the dying, where, you know, people don't want to be anywhere near death, so they kind of shun them. And a lot of these houses you go into are just very lonely because nobody's there. Even members of their family sometimes can't handle it. So when the dog comes in the door and is all lit up and all excited, it's a big deal, and it matters. And Izzy has picked up on it. I had to sort of, the training was really to show him that the people were the work. So I think that challenge was very powerful. But we had, you know, we made great friends. You know, he's much admired. People so appreciate him coming there. And I've seen him read people and get into bed, get into wheelchairs, get very comfortable with people. He's quite a creature. And I think it's been a great gift to, you know, we go into these homes, which are not depressing. When you go in there with a dog, there's a lot of happiness and love in there. And, you know, often when I was depressed, I'd want to do hospice work. You know, it's just a strange thing to say.
Yeah. Boy. I haven't had occasion recently to visit someone who was very ill or at the end of life, but next time I'm going to think of Izzy.
Yes, that's the great gift of a dog. You know, I wrote a book about hospice and I put up a hospice journal on my website. And, you know, you think, well, nobody's going to want to read about hospice. But when you put Izzy in front of it, he makes it accessible. So I think Izzy has done as much for the hospice idea as, you know, a million ad campaigns, because people will approach the subject from the perspective of a dog. And people would want pictures taken with Izzy, and they would talk to Izzy. So I think it's another example of the power of an animal to take a subject like that and make it palatable to people and, you know, in a way that it really wouldn't have been without that.
Mm. Well, also thinking of Izzy, thinking of how he handles the situation, offers us a lesson in terms of, before we enter the door, putting our lives aside and being in the moment and being there.
Yes, you know, hospice teaches the idea of active listening. And when you go into a hospice situation, you have to behave in much the opposite of the way that you normally behave. Because you're not there to cheer people up, and you're not there to tell them it's going to be all right, because it's not going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to meet people where they are. You're not there to tell them anything, really. You're there to listen. And dogs, of course, are the greatest active listeners in the world. when Izzy looks at somebody and he locks onto them, they start talking and he listens. And that's the gift he gives them, is he allows them to be themselves. They don't have to be in a good mood or be happy or be upbeat or pretend everything's okay or to worry about him. And that's the gift, really, I think, is that it says, okay, I know where you are, I know it's okay, and we're going to meet you there. That's probably the greatest gift that he brings to them, really.
Yeah.
And that's what they need. They need just to be listened to.
Yeah.
So I always make a note when I go in the door, I'm there really to take Izzy there and shut up, you know. And I call myself Izzy's driver. And that really works, you know. You can't, you know, and if I show up without Izzy, it's a whole different story.
Yeah. Well, I know that you are going to celebrate this Thanksgiving coming up this week, Thanksgiving 2009. And, you know, the day after has been designated by a fellow by the name of Dave Isay and his StoryCorps project as a day of listening, where we sit down and talk with one another about one another. And I think that's just a terrific thing. And I wanted to mention that here, in addition to wishing you a happy Thanksgiving and our listeners as well.
Well, thank you. That's a great idea. That's much better than Black Friday.
Oh, yeah.
A much better idea.
Yeah.
And that's something we just, you know, we need to do. And I think that's something animals definitely taught me how to do, because that's what they do. They listen and pay attention.
Yeah. They don't care if you got a plasma TV.
No, they don't care. They don't care what you look like, what you smell like. They're ready to listen to you. If you got food, they care about that.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it, John. We're out of time. I look forward to talking with you next time. Maybe we'll talk when Rose in a Storm comes out in the fall of 2010.
I'm very excited. Thank you so much. It was a great interview.
Take care now.
You too.
John Katz. He is the author most recently of Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. And do check out his website, www.bedlamfarm.com.